Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. And our guest today is Brett Stevens, columnist for the New York Times, formerly of the Wall Street Journal, and used to be editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. Do they have this right?
You have that all correct.
So welcome. This is your first time on the Bulwark Podcast. You have been on our list from the very, very beginning. So now I think it's complete.
Well, I hope it's not the last. I love what you're doing. And my only comment is that I sometimes wonder whether the Bulwark should be renamed the Sane Asylum.
Okay, it's interesting you should mention
that. A lonely island in that respect.
You know, okay, it's interesting you should say that, because this is a constant, whether it's a theme that I talk about or I just think about all the time, is living in a world in which you kind of wonder whether it is we will become sane ever again. So I was going to ask you the question, what do you worry about when you're like lying in bed? What do you worry about? I'll give you my answer. Is that this will never be over, and that Western civilization just loses its freaking mind?
Well, I'm worried that we are undergoing a process which constantly is normalizing what was previously not normal. So it's the process that Moynihan many years ago called defining deviancy down, but we're not doing it with respect to criminality, which is what Moynihan was talking about in that essay in the early 1990s. We're doing it about institutional and constitutional norms. So my real fear isn't that there'll be a sudden outbreak of war or a deep economic recession, although those things can happen. I think those are events from which the United States can recover. My fear is really that we are the proverbial lobster in a pot, not noticing that we're being cooked, that we are becoming accustomed to behavior from our leaders that would have been unthinkable just 10 or 15 years ago, and that ultimately that's going to have consequences that we will be slow to notice and we will find hard to shed.
Yeah, I think that's a good analogy. You know, you wrote a piece a few weeks back, maybe a few months back now. I feel like we live in a time warp. That Trump critics will ultimately be vindicated, even though we are human scum. But on the other hand, and this is a point that I think that some of our listeners probably need to hear, how weird it is to be a conservative never Trumper at this moment right now. And I think you know what I mean when I ask this next question. You know, a lot of liberals don't like you, despite the fact, right? I mean, Brett, I mean, a lot of liberals, particularly readers of the New York Times, really seem to have made kind of a hobby out of disliking you, despite the fact that you devoted the last 3 years in being one of the most vocal critics of Donald Trump. I mean, we really are orphans at this political moment, aren't we?
Well, I don't agree entirely in this sense. The people who really dislike me aren't really liberals. They're progressives. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a real distinction between the two. Now, the progressives are very loud, I think incredibly nasty. They always were. Today's progressives were the radicals of the 60s, were the Trotskyites of the 30s and so on. And they have found a way to magnify their voice through social media, where they're extremely active. I don't think they speak for a majority of Democrats. I don't think they speak for a majority of, say, you know, relatively conventional liberals who may be, say, pro-choice and believe in the necessity of a welfare state or of a expansive health benefits from government, but don't like cancel culture, don't like the talk on the far left of you know, getting away from capitalism, reverting to socialism, and so on. They're kind of Bill Clinton Democrats, and I think I do just fine with a lot of them. The problem is that you don't hear from them because it takes a certain kind of personality to be hyperactive on Twitter or to be scoping out the comments on the Times' website.
Yeah, we often make the point that Twitter is not real life, but I think a lot of people miss this. I think one of the nicer things about being Never Trumper, I was looking for a different word, is the fact that I think some of the things that we have said are going to age well. over time, sooner or later. And I have to tell you, at the risk of sucking up, I went back and I read your Daniel Pearl memorial lecture that you gave.
Oh, yeah.
before Donald Trump actually took office.
Yeah, it was in January, maybe February of 2017. I'd have to look.
And you really talked about something that, you know, the shock and the disillusionment of watching, you know, people that we had thought were thoughtful and principled conservatives, you know, give themselves over to Trumpianism, including the illiberal politics. And you did a critique of this. You said, watching this process unfold has been particularly painful for me as a conservative columnist. I find myself in the awkward position of having recently become popular among some of my liberal peers precisely because I haven't changed my opinions about anything. By contrast, I've suddenly become unpopular among some of my former fans on the right. You've accused of suffering from Trump derangement syndrome. But I thought really the stuff that stuck with me, the portion was where you are sort of relying on the book, The Captive Mind.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book.
Who talks about, you know, being in Eastern Europe, watching intellectuals who were not coerced into going along with Stalin, but made the transition willingly. And if I can read what you wrote, they wanted to believe, they were willing to adapt, they thought they could do more good from the inside, they convinced themselves that their former principles didn't fit with the march of history, or that to hold fast to one's belief was a sign of priggishness and pig-headedness. They felt that to reject the new order of things was to relegate themselves to irrelevance and oblivion. They mocked their former friends who refused to join the new order as morally vain reactionaries. I mean, that is exactly the description of the world that we live in today, isn't it?
Well, that's pretty much it. And, you know, it's funny. When I was in college, I graduated high school in 1991, so right around the time the Soviet Union ended. And in college, I developed a kind of interest in the literature of the totalitarian era, which at the time, with the Soviet Union gone and the end of history supposedly having been achieved, seemed like an antiquarian interest. I was reading Hannah Arendt, I was reading Milosz, the writer of The Captive Mind, some of Havel, Václav Havel's writings. A lot of it, not just fiction, but there was a great deal of philosophy too, and I was just kind of fascinated by how it was that people kind of voluntarily gave themselves over to forms of politics which, under different circumstances, might have seemed inconceivable. And then, more than 20 years later, 25 years later, when the Trump phenomenon began, that literature suddenly became, I thought, incredibly relevant again, because it was so psychologically astute. What it really got at was that the reason regimes like Stalin's and other despicable regimes survived wasn't so much because they exercised brutal force. It's because they played on an instinct within many of us that simply wants to go along, simply wants to participate in whatever it is the large cultural stream is or political stream is of the day. That is to say that there was an element of voluntarism in totalitarian societies which was larger than I think many people on the outside suspected. And I think that there's a certain amount of truth even in free societies too. You see it to the extent that people are terrified of saying something on social media that is going to make them unpopular, that is going to get them ratioed or whatever. It's difficult even in ostensibly liberal political circumstances, that is, you know, free political circumstances, to swim against the tide. And once Trump captured the nomination, Republicans I think the vast majority of Republicans would have gone for him, by the way, just as I think that Bernie Sanders or someone even further to the left were to get the Democratic nomination, most Democrats would go along with him. It's not a matter of right or left. There's an element of human nature that's at play here.
You know, I was having a conversation with a Democrat yesterday in D.C. who was asking that question, saying, I wonder whether or not my tribe, my folks on among Democrats would go along with this if this was on our party. And I said, yeah, pretty likely. I mean, you know, how many Democrats broke with Bill Clinton? And that's sort of a minor example of all of this. But I do think that most people, you can't overstate, I think, this, the desire to belong, to remain attached to your tribe. And there's so many other incentives. You know, it's not just your family, your social life, your political career, your quote unquote relevance. You know, you really do have to be a contrarian to be able to go against the stream. But even given that, are you surprised, as we're sitting here talking today, there is not a single Republican elected official in Congress, with the possible exception of Mitt Romney, who is willing to publicly break with Donald Trump despite this cascade of evidence about Ukraine? I mean, it's one thing, you know, we watched as, you know, so many quote unquote principled conservatives found ways to rationalize Trump. But we're at this a moment where it's everyone. It feels like everyone. Are you surprised at the extent of all of this?
Yeah, I am a little surprised. I mean, I just didn't realize that it was so much fun being in Congress. You know, one of the things that has, I think, sustained me professionally is a sense deep down that if this journalism gig doesn't work out, I'll go and do something else. And I'm hopefully resourceful enough that I'll figure it out. And I don't understand what it is about being a United States senator and spending half your day trying to raise money or suck up to people you don't entirely like that makes it so difficult for these senators to simply express themselves as they, you know, candidly. That kind of shocks me. I mean, does Mitt Romney, he's going to be senator for another 5 years. He doesn't really need the job. Lamar Alexander has been in the Senate for an awfully long time. His mentor was Howard Baker, who was the Republican who, to his credit, turned against Nixon back in 1974. Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, they all have made their distaste with the president's plan. And what really shocks me, Charlie, is that it's not just that they aren't willing to go along with impeachment or conviction. I can understand the argument that the president has done something terrible, but as we are within a year of an election, why don't we let the people make a decision, right, about his fate?
Right.
I get that argument.
Yeah.
That's an easy argument. What I don't get is why none of them will say this behavior is disgraceful, it's unacceptable. Under different circumstances, it might be impeachable. We need to stand up against this and make our voices heard with a clear vote of censure. I just think that impeachment and removal from office is a step too far. None of them will say that. And that's what strikes me. That's the aspect of normalization that I'm getting at, which is they're not, I get it that you don't want to apply the death penalty. What I don't get is that you're not even willing to say guilty and here's the fine. That's what I don't get.
Yeah, or the willingness to buy into the conspiracy theories we've been discussing, the sort of the bizarre turn by people like Senator John Kennedy, who decided to go full Devin Nunes. There's lots of ways of dodging and weaving as opposed to coming out and saying, yeah, the Ukrainians did meddle in our elections, and it's pretty much drawing some sort of an equivalency between what happened with Ukraine and what happened with the Russian meddling, which is kind of this is the bat guana level of discourse that apparently we deserve.
This is all these terms about whataboutism, gaslighting, all getting away from what strikes me as the obvious and central fact, which is the president to extort a political favor from an embattled Democratic ally fighting, struggling literally for its survival in order to besmirch a domestic political opponent, withheld and pounded congressional funds, didn't tell the truth about what he was doing to his congressional supporters, and only relented in giving the money when he found himself under congressional pressure. I mean, the whole thing is a scandal by any measure, and nobody is willing to call it even that. Why? Because they don't want to get crosswise with a president that you'll pretty well, this we will remember as among our very worst.
Okay, I want to get into the weird fascination that some people on the Republican side seem to have with Vladimir Putin and the Russians. But first, let's hear a word from our sponsor.
Hiring is challenging, and it used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter. In fact, go to ZipRecruiter.com/begin. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, and they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you cannot miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. Right now, listeners here can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/begin. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BEGIN. ZipRecruiter.com/begin. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Okay, we're back with New York Times columnist Brett Stevens. One of the extraordinary things that we've seen, even watching the extraordinary abandonment of so many principles on the part of conservatives, has been the willingness of some Republicans to become willing dupes of Russian propaganda. Maybe this is obvious that in order to curry favor with President Trump, who has this weird fascination with Vladimir Putin. Apparently, you know, maybe that's just the price of admission here. But, you know, as someone who's been a student of the Cold War and totalitarianism, just give me your thoughts on watching Republicans, including conservatives like Tucker Carlson, going on the air and enthusiastically saying, we should be siding with Russia against Ukraine. How did the world get turned upside down?
I mean, this is one of the most profound questions, I think, that could be asked. It is flabbergasting to me when I think about the behavior of certain Fox News anchors when Obama responded weakly to Putin's invasion of Ukraine, his seizure of Crimea in 2014. To find them making precisely the opposite kind of arguments. During the Cold War, one of the regular things that the right often said about the left, and sometimes with a certain amount of justice, is they were Brezhnevs or Khrushchevs or whoever it was, they were the useful idiots. In the early 1980s, the first major international political battle that I remember vividly was the question of deploying cruise missiles and Pershing missiles to Western Europe as a counterforce against the Russian deployment of the SS-20s. And there was that huge movement of nuclear disarmament. And the consistent line by Republicans and conservatives was that the disarmament campaign was, in effect, an arm of Russian propaganda. It had many of the people who participated in it did it, of course, out of sincere conviction, but it's also the case that it was serving the aims of the Soviet Union and its satellite states. We later learned, in fact, that a great deal of Russian intelligence work went to covertly supporting parts of the movement. So this was, for 45 years, the consistent view of conservatives, the rank and file, the intelligentsia, the political leadership. Now it's been completely overturned, and it's been overturned simply because anything that Trump says or does is going to be adopted or justified or explained and rationalized by Trump's by Trump's defenders, especially those who are part of a kind of intelligentsia of sorts, the talking heads. And all you can say is I mean, this is what I get to when I say I'm a never Trumper. I have not changed my views. They're the ones who have changed. I have remained consistent in what I thought, and it's just a kind of a numbing feeling when where has the rest of the party gone, and why do they all now sound the way that the far left sounded in the 1970s and 1980s when they were more sympathetic to the guy in the Kremlin than they were to the people who were fighting the Kremlin.
You know, and as we're talking, the president is over in London at a new NATO summit, and there was a time when it was, I think there was bipartisan consensus that NATO was a fundamental, foundational alliance that was not controversial. And yet now, as we watch the president over at the NATO summit, there's this anxiety. What is he going to do? Is he going to blow it up? Does the president of the United States actually stand behind NATO? We're at this bizarre moment where the president seems at times to be more hostile to our NATO allies than he is to people like President Erdogan or President Putin. And this is also a tremendous reversal. And there's very little pushback among professional Republicans.
Yeah, I was quite struck that Trump was extremely tough in a face-to-face public meeting with Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, who in fact made some comments about NATO. He was much tougher on Macron, much more willing to cut an ally off at the knees than he ever would be in the company of Putin, Erdogan, or his dear friend Kim Jong-un. And I think there's something psychological at work there. It's a kind of a classic bullying type. Bully is always willing to be mean with the guys he doesn't fear. It's the tough guys that the bully is genuinely afraid of. I mean, every time Trump has had a press conference after a Putin or an Erdogan meeting, the tone is always unbelievably ingratiating and conciliatory. When he last met with Erdogan in the White House a few weeks ago, he talked about how he was a big fan of Erdogan. Erdogan is an anti-Semitic Islamist who supports Hamas, and up until a few years ago was helping fund or funnel ISIS fighters into Syria, and yet he's a big fan. So you have a president who is going around blowing up what used to be the constitutive elements of the free world, and again, Republicans sort of shrug, and then they make the kind of obvious point that yes, the Europeans should pay a little more, while ignoring the elephant in the room. And by the way, that always seems to be the GOP defense of Trump, which is that they will find some small point on which he has a point, right? And then ignore the most obvious fact that Trump has systematically gone about casting aspersions and doubt about the viability of NATO from before the time he was in office right up until the present. It's the same with some of these investigations. Yes, the Ukrainians were concerned that the head of the Trump campaign was a guy who had been in the employ of a Ukrainian president who was a Russian puppet.
Like, Paul Manafort.
Wouldn't you be concerned that Paul Manafort was potentially an act of blackmail because he seemed to have been on the take to the tune of $11 or $12 million from the Yanukovych government? Who wouldn't be concerned about that? Who wouldn't be concerned that Carter Page, a man of no obvious accomplishments, who had done business in Russia, was suddenly seemed to have been there were efforts by Russian agents to cultivate him. Wouldn't the FBI be a little bit worried that this guy suddenly turns up as a senior foreign policy advisor to the presumptive Republican nominee? I mean, those are things that normal people, those are observations normal people would make, and yet they simply escape the grasp of the people who are Trump's defenders.
You know, I remember being very concerned that Barack Obama did not have a sufficient appreciation of the concept of American exceptionalism. He seemed rather uncomfortable with America as the exceptional country, but. In retrospect, I think he understood American values fundamentally better than Donald Trump, who honestly does not believe. This is really striking to me, being around conservatives, that even with this, hyper patriotism and America first, Donald Trump does not believe American is exceptional.
Yeah, no. In fact, so you can YouTube this, and I've done it on a few occasions. Sometime in 2015 or so, maybe 2016, on the campaign trail, then candidate Trump was being interviewed, and he says explicitly, "I don't like the idea of American exceptionalism. We're not better than anyone else." Now, when Barack Obama made that comment, "Yes, I believe in American exceptionalism as an American, just as the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism," and so on, right? The Fox News crowd threw a fit. Oh my goodness, the man does not believe in American exceptionalism. But Trump literally doesn't believe in it, and he doesn't even begin to grasp what it is that might make America exceptional, why we're not just a nation state, and why nationalism is not, in fact, at the core of the American creed. He doesn't understand any of that. Obama, at least, and this is to his credit, used to say, only in America can a guy from a biracial background with a name like Barack Obama aspire to become, and indeed become, the president of the United States. That is, in fact, something that would never happen in nearly any other country, or perhaps any other country in the world. So again, it's the Trumpians who have no concept of why America is different, why our founding ideals are unique and worth defending, why it's the last best hope on earth. So the patriotism that Republicans are busy, but at least the Trumpian Republicans are busily espousing, has very little to do with why I am so fiercely attached to this country as the son of a refugee who came here and was able to rise according to my own merits, something that wouldn't have happened if my poor mother had remained in Italy for the rest of her life.
And this is this goes to the heart of American exceptionalism and a lot of conservatives, unfortunately, are now rejecting the idea that America is an idea, even prominent, respectable conservatives. But Donald Trump specifically does not think that there is a moral element to international relations. It is, for him, it is simply the jungle, big eat small, etc., purely transactional. I thought his comments about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi were so revealing when he's asked about who's responsible. And he said something like, maybe the whole world is responsible because the world's a nasty place, which is pretty much very consistent with his view when he was asked about, Vladimir Putin kills people. And his response was, well, so do we. We kill people. Everybody does this sort of thing. There's nothing that makes us better or is some principle that we stand for against someone else.
And it's remarkable how that, in fact, mirrors the language of the hard left. I just wrote a column the other day about these two very remarkable dissidents, José Daniel Ferreira in Cuba, who's in prison fighting for his life against the Castro regime, and then Ali Alinejad in Iran, who is in prison because his sister is a human rights activist who encourages women to remove their headscarves, their hijab. And one of the things I found depressing reading some of the comments to the column, some of those that were clearly on the from the far left end of the spectrum, was the constant effort to draw an equivalence between regimes that put prisoners of conscience into jail simply because they disagree with the absence of democracy and human rights, and the United States, which has lots of people in prison because they've committed crimes and have gone through a process of, have been given due process and so on. And so, one of the complaints that we conservatives often had about the old left was this habit of creating moral equivalencies between dictatorships and democracies. Who else does that? Donald Trump. I mean, so again, it's this upside down universe that you and I are discussing here.
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, you said it was depressing, but it's also familiar. You kind of expect to hear that from the left, because this is the debate about moral equivalency and moral relativism is something that we've had for the last 50 years. But at least we knew where conservatives stood in that debate up until 5 minutes ago. And I think that's what's disorienting, you know.
So this was my ultimate argument in 2016 as to why I voted for Hillary Clinton. In America, it seemed to me up until 2016, there was only one political party that stood for my concept of freedom. My sense was, if the Republican Party loses that to a populist demagogue like Trump, then we're really in a world of trouble. One of the things that's so dangerous about what much of the left did over the past 50 years is that they created the intellectual architecture, if you will, for a set of ideas that were somewhat dangerous in their hands, although in many ways just simply frivolous, because they really were relegated to the academy, and then developed these ideas without thinking that they might be adopted and weaponized by the far right. I mean, so just take something like identity politics. Identity politics was always kind of a left-wing thing. Well, turns out you can have an identity politics that suits the far right in the form of white identity politics, or the view that the Constitution is just, you know, ink on parchment that means nothing, that was written by hypocritical men of their day. The letter of the Constitution is sort of whatever you want to make of it. Well, Trump is not much of a constitutionalist either. Or the idea that, you know, truth is relative. Conservatives, you know, Charlie always insisted the truth is not relative. The truth
right.
is a concept that means something, right? It's not just what I say is true. Well, Trump is the ultimate relative. So Trump has taken some of these, I think, very dangerous ideas developed on the far left, handed them to the far right, and now the far left is suddenly sort of maybe asking itself, what kind of Frankenstein do we have here? Well, to some extent, it's a Frankenstein they helped create.
Yeah, of course, that's what they throw at us. And, you know, speaking of identity politics, I have to admit that I am increasingly frustrated by the. And again, it is not new. It's the style of argument that we get among our progressive friends that don't actually deal with the substance of the arguments that we make. It's the simply, well, you are a white male, so therefore blank. That reductionism of every debate to the identity of the speaker. And the sense, I don't think they have the full sense of how illiberal that is.
Well, I don't think they understand that. Not only was that exactly the language that was used to oppress minorities for hundreds of years, but it's exactly the kind of language that might repress minorities again. Because if you can say, well, you are a white male, so your view doesn't count, at some point, God forbid, but at some point in the future, some majority of whites could conceivably create a political order in which they say, well, you are a minority female, so your view doesn't count as it been, you know, in centuries past. So it's just extraordinarily, it's worse than frivolous. It's dangerous because it's a game two can play. And I think the left was too late to realize that.
Yeah. And of course, it shrinks that zone of space where we can actually have a conversation where you can disagree without being tribal about this. So I had to ask you about this. The piece you wrote, The United States is Starting to Look Like Ukraine. This really hit me. And you have spent a lot of time like writing about Ukraine. Most people, you know things about Ukraine and Ukrainian politics and the, you know, particular nature of the corruption in Ukraine, which includes the criminalization of political opposition. But this one paragraph, though, where you say that, you know, we should be astounded by the fact that the president is the chief purveyor of conspiracy theories. It doesn't because we've been living in a country undergoing its own dismal process of Ukrainianization, of treating fictions as facts and propaganda as journalism and political opponents as criminals and political offices as business ventures and personal relatives as diplomatic representatives and legal fixers as shadow cabinet members and extortion as foreign policy and toadyism as patriotism and fellow citizens as human scum and mortal enemies as long-lost friends, and then acting as if all of this is perfectly normal. This is more than a high crime. It is a clear and present danger to our security institutions and moral hygiene. That's a hell of a paragraph, Brett.
Well, thank you. It's almost just a sentence. But thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Every clause is like a hammer because this is what we have been dealing with, watching that transmutation of all of those things, and to realize that, yeah, this is not a completely new model. There are countries that have had this political culture before, and we had assumed until relatively recently that we were immune to that.
Right. That's just the thing. I think we neglected the extent to which good government in the United States was held up by a barely visible net of values, expectations, norms, sensibilities that has just dissolved in the past few years. And this is a complaint I really have with some of my friends or sometimes former friends in the conservative movement. They'll say, oh, you see, the system of checks and balances is working fine. You know, the machine that the founders devised is good enough to contain Trump's worst instincts and channel his better ones. Everything is just fine. That, in fact, is not conservatism. You know, years ago, George Will, at some point, I think it was Will, but he made a very astute point, which he said, you know, liberal governance is not a matter of physics. It's a matter of biology. You know, to think about it as physics, as sort of force and counterforce, interest and counterinterest, and so on, is a mistake. That the web of things that makes the organism function is much more complex and subtle than it is a matter of kind of equations and physics that operate in the vacuum of space. And I always thought that was a very subtle and fine point, that that real conservatism is simply attentive to the fact that if you damage a kidney, you're going to have problems throughout the system, right? It's not, things aren't easily separated into individual entities. And so the conservative idea that Trump is a totally survivable event because the structure of our constitutional structure is so sound that it can contain people like him, I think it's fundamentally flawed. I mean, this is the point I keep coming back to. And again, it's one of the astonishments that the same people, or many of the same people who in the 1990s were talking about the death of outrage in connection to the Clinton scandals, can't seem to summon any outrage when it comes to the guy who just happens to be ostensibly on their side.
You know, this is the thing I was talking on yesterday's podcast with A.B. Stoddard about this, that what we found out is that checks and balances is more of a metaphor than a reality. And that one of the things that Donald Trump has either discovered or simply exposed is how much of that, how fragile that is, that if you ignore those norms, if you are a dishonorable man in what is essentially an honor system, and how much stuff you could break. But also what you're also describing is the importance of culture as opposed to simply positive law, that conservatives used to instinctively understand that you know, again, you know, pre-Trump, people would not have been controversial on the right to talk about the importance of cultural values and those moral norms, as opposed to simply relying on the black letter of the law. And now that seems to be in eclipse. Brett Stevens, thank you so much for all the time you've spent with us today on the Bulwark Podcast. I appreciate it very much.
It's an honor to speak to you, Charlie. You're one of the men I have admired most in recent years, and it's great to be connected to this podcast.
Well, you know that the feeling is mutual. Thank you very much. And thank you all for listening to the Bulwark Podcast, which was brought to you today by ZipRecruiter. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.